January 28, 1974.
Tom, what?
No,
please summarize your background. It'll be done briefly.
Well, I worked in Terry Sanford's campaign for governor, and then I was for several months that fall the assistant to the chairman of the Democratic Party during the Kennedy campaign in North Carolina. And then for 4 years I was Terry's administrative assistant. And then it was my non-political period. For 4 years I was with the Richardson Foundation in Greensboro. And then I came up here with Congressman Pryor in 69. I've been here in the 5 years that he's been in Washington.
Were you involved in his campaign for governor and Congress?
In the campaign for governor, I really was not. I was in the governor's office then, and in spite of the fact that everybody thought it was being run over there, it was not. And I had a limited involvement in it, mostly involved with watching the Ku Klux Klan and its participation in that race. I was served on a kind of steering committee for his congressional campaign, and had a considerable involvement in it, just as one of several friends in Greensboro that was that were helping him with the plan.
What was the plan activity in that region?
Well, most of that stuff is under seal. That story is a long one. We could go through all day today. It involves them going out and burning crosses at the courthouses in 33 counties before the first primary and everything, and great confusion as to who was responsible for this. The Lake forces suspected that it was being done to embarrass Dr. Lake, and they suspected everybody's being responsible for it. And I'm not certain of the whole story because nobody's ever... most of what I knew was because of the relationship we had with the Anti-Defamation League, who had several investigators, including one spy in the Klan, and some other sources of information. We were really just trying to keep up with them for a number of things. So I'm not sure what the true story is. You'd have to get a lot of people who know a little bit about it to put it together. I suspect that they were used by Governor Moore's people to embarrass Dr. Lake. Between the first and second primary, Dr. Lake sent word that that had happened. He was going quiet. But it couldn't be proved. Almost all the people involved in that had an untimely death during the next 3 or 4 years, so I'm not sure whether the true story will ever be known. One committed suicide, one died of cancer, one died in a car wreck, and one was sent to prison.
These were planned people.
Mm-hmm.
There's some suspicion they also organized an assassination plot. They were going to kill Rich at the hotel on the night of the second primary if he won. Had a very interesting code to explain that he was dead. Somebody was going to call the other one and say that the preacher has left town.
Was any of that ever documented?
No. I think it would be hard to do it. Dwayne Walls knows a good bit of it. Or Jim Batten won, I can't remember. I think it was Dwayne. All we knew was that there were some informants, one of whom supposedly heard this plan, four men sitting in a cafe somewhere. And that sort of stuff. There was enough coincidence in the information. I believe that it might have been true. Whether they'd ever gone through with that, I don't know. It became pointless, but it was obvious that he wasn't going to win.
In the years that you've been
here, however, was probably the only candidate to ever concede defeat in North Carolina, surrounded by private detectives and plainclothes bodyguards and things like that.
It's his own job. My intern is referred to
the other. Do you think those days are gone, Governor of North Carolina?
The Klan.
What sort of level of hate is that?
Over race. I suppose it could come up over something else. I think it is over being a great, a very much of a force, I think so.
My internist is also his.
I think two-party contest destroys some of it. You don't have, I know of few places where Republicans would be willing in North Carolina to bear the label of a racist approach. They certainly wouldn't in our district. No question you have people who still have those, you know, who are still prejudiced. So they had as many hecklers as they had before.
As you think back over the years you've been involved in politics, directly or indirectly, any other major changes that have occurred other than this one race?
I remember my wife.
Well, since I have had any, I had much involvement in it, I suppose, and the rise of the Republican Party, decline in racial field, I think probably an end to any sense of geography in North Carolina politics, with the exception maybe of the extreme west, might still have some sense. I'm not, there's some people that think the east still does. I'm not convinced that it does anymore. The Piedmont doesn't have any at all.
You think the old one senator from the east and one from the west concept is convenient?
Well, we'll find out. Because we stand maybe to have two from within 20 miles of each other in the least populated part of the state. I'm not sure that it has, but I must say that everybody else thinks it has. Haven't found anybody else that thinks that tradition. Oh. Except Sam Irvin the third.
But afterwards,
Yates. Is he interested in that,
right? Yeah, it has been, but I don't think. It must not be serious, because if it was, I believe his father would be doing something about it. His father didn't show any signs of helping him. You know, there are other changes. The woman's role in it obviously has changed a good bit. I think it's difficult to have a woman's campaign manager and women campaign managers in the counties anymore if you've got to have, in other words, a special appeal in which you segregate women from the appeal. I think probably it's gone. You have to make it, definitely make an appeal, but I mean it has to be on another basis.
Very traumatic.
I think it's been a change in the kinds of influences. When Terry ran in 60, it was still possible for the approach of having some key people in each county as being a determining influence in how the county voted. There were somewhere 5 or 6 people being for you probably meant you'd carry the county. I think that's less true now because of television. I don't know. I doubt it. We've come yet to the point where you could run for office in Raleigh and never leave town and win, but you could probably do pretty well.
You consider it. Would you consider the election of Helms as proof that television has completely changed campaign techniques and strategies in North Carolina?
No. Because I think any victory is a combination of several factors. I doubt that someone like he could have been elected to office without television, because my impression of how he does in a crowd, you know, in the going around campaigning, is that he does not do that well. I'm sure that Nick won several times, several votes for every one that Helms won on the basis of standing somewhere talking to somebody. So I suppose television was a critical factor in it, but he had that. He had George McGovern. He had some issues. And some people thought that he was native born and his opponent wasn't. You know, a number of things contributed to that. But I doubt he could have ever, well, obviously he wouldn't have been known, but I, not just because of his career, but his approach to the campaign, I think would have been, he'd been much weaker if he hadn't had television.
How do you interpret the 72 election law in North Carolina insofar as setting trends and the significance of that election? Elected the first time this century, elected a Republican senator, first time a Republican governor, certainly the first time ever a combination.
The Democratic candidates must have had bad advice. No, I don't think that at all. I don't know whether it set any trends because it was...
Either that or they failed to take what good advice was offered.
That's undoubtedly to be it. Those who were taking advice seemed to do better than those who weren't. Well, you know, I don't know whether it's established any trends because it... following it came all the events of the last year, which... it's conceivable that the Democrats will win back seats in the General Assembly and elect a senator and all of that, and I suppose people will then interpret that as being a reversal of the trend or something like that. I think that McGovern was a tremendous influence in the election. And more significant than that, I think, was the fact that the turnout of voters, but I suppose I blame that on McGovern. Now, I don't know what you found about the people who didn't vote, so I'm only guessing about the people who didn't vote. I assume that a great many of the people who didn't vote were people who could not bring themselves to vote for one of the presidential candidates. Interestingly enough, we had apparently fewer blank ballots in North Carolina than we had in 68, when we had 100,000 blank ballots, 64, when we had 100,000 blank ballots in the governor's race, which means that Dan Moore's margin was actually sort of inflated if you realize the unusual high number of blank ballots we had in the governor's race. 16,000 blank ballots in the presidential race. But I don't think we had anything like that anymore. No, thank you. in 72. Let me say one other thing, because we'll confirm Mr. DeRees. I do think that it certainly marked the emergence of ticket splitting as a household habit in North Carolina. When I look at Guilford County, which I'd be more familiar with than anything else right now, it's just hard sometimes to find any reason in the way people vote in terms of the jumping back and forth between philosophies represented by the candidates. And you know, when you find somebody that's a strong George Wallace supporter and a strong Rich Pryor supporter, a strong Tom Gilmore supporter, and things like that, it's obvious that labels don't mean that much to them. Well, it had the Voting Rights Act had the effect, I think, of making it less attractive to appear to be anti-black.
Helms didn't seem to suffer from it,
though. Well, I think he... I think he did a good job of appearing to be anti-black to those people whom it would be an advantage, and not to be to those would be a disadvantage. I don't remember him talking very much about race.
He didn't have to. You know where he stands.
Well, it's the same sort of advantage that Nixon has in going to China. If you're sort of established as being against something, then every time you do something that seems to be contrary to that, I think you can get away with it, because people sort of say, well, he really is not pro-communist. He's really not soft on communism because of all those things he did back then. And Helms didn't have to worry about, he could probably have half his staff up here black, and nobody would ever pay much attention to him.
Specifically about
busing, didn't it? Mm-hmm.
Not that much. Didn't have to.
Truth is, he really didn't talk about a whole lot of anything. He ran very effective ads, making it, you know, unattractive to vote for his opponent. But I don't really remember any great issues that he raised. And he'd do that, and then he'd come back and be the clean guy by saying, well, I don't do that anymore. You know. I question how much, I don't know how much race played in those races, though, because a lot of people say, they say that they're against him because of what he had to say about the war, but the truth is they don't want to vote for him because they think he's too friendly with niggers, you know. So I'm not sure that people are telling you they believe this on this issue because they don't want you to know that the real basis for that is something else. The curious phenomenon we had in 1960 of all the people who were voting against Terry because he'd endorsed John Kennedy, but they were wild about John Kennedy. We found in 1968 in Richard's district that the first choice of 40% of the Wallace voters was Robert Kennedy. My guess is, however, if Richard endorsed Robert Kennedy for president, a lot of those people would have just been enraged about it. Explain that.
You'll have another 60% of the Wallace vote.
Well, no.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
I think it's something else. I think the Kennedy thing was, the Terry was, because it somehow represented to them a betrayal of the South. If you were from the South, you didn't do that. The reason Fritz Hollings never could make up his mind to go ahead and do it. Kennedy, you could forgive because he was a Yankee. And he couldn't help being that way. You could be for him, but somebody else to. I'm not sure that that's right. But everything about the only part of the country that ever lost the war.
Looking back in 10 years' perspective, how do you evaluate the
from my unbiased, objective standpoint? Well, I'm sure that it will. Answering now as a historian, and not facetiously, I'm satisfied that it will probably rank. If you're writing history in the 1990s, you'll describe it probably as the greatest or one of the two greatest administrations in the history of North Carolina. That most of North Carolina history for the rest of this century will be a reaction to it.
Why specifically do you think that it would rank by 1990 as one or two great administrations of the century?
First, because I do think that the rest of North Carolina history would be a reaction to it. Because you find that people today in North Carolina politics, conservative, moderate, or liberal, talk the language that began then. Well, just a phrase, quality education, which was made fun of. Everybody talks about it now. It has no philosophical identification at all. The idea of the governor having artists into the mansion. I mean, every governor does that now. The idea that state initiative from the governor's office to go out and start, that really begins with Hodges. Hodges did it, all the things that Hodges did in seeking industry. Then the governor's office began to do in seeking in education and in the arts. In continuing industrial development, an active governor's office, going out and promoting change in the state, which every governor does now and every governor promises to do. It's hard to find an innovation in state government since 1964. Which isn't either some modification or refinement of something that was started then, or can't be traced to that kind of activity. The style of governors. Until 1961, governors still were some form of the other North Carolina where modification applied to it. Even Luther Hodges was. And since 1961, there's been some
shape or other. He
sat in his office and talked to people, and at 11:30 every morning went down to the drugstore and had a Coke. And people said, isn't he great? He's just as common as the rest of us. And he didn't upset the congressional delegation. Nobody knew him anywhere else until he came to Washington and wore the collar. Taught Sunday school. Acted as though he was as limited in his power as the governor of North Carolina really is by statute, by the Constitution.
Do you think part of the legacy of the Sanders administration was to develop an activist role in the governor's office despite the lack of institutional power?
Yeah. And it was easier to do, though, because of Luther Hodges. Because Hodges, in a limited area, had begun to do that. And he had an easier time doing it because he got to be governor longer than anybody else in history. And he got there through death. And had no political battles, had no the enemies he made after he got in office, almost entirely.
Why do you think the North Carolina failed to develop any tradition of people moving up from the lieutenant governor's office?
Really doing a hell of a job.
It's hard to say they've been unable to.
Why is that tradition failed to develop in North Carolina?
I think in North Carolina there has, in the past, and I can't explain why, except that I think tradition sometimes occur because it happens twice in a row and then everybody assumes it's a tradition and people write about it until you become a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think it's always been a feeling in North Carolina that once defeated, defeated forever. You don't find a lot of people that ran, you know, that run for office again having been defeated. You certainly find examples, Rich being an example. Very few that run for the same office again, though. And you had, in the first half of the 20th century, you had one man make it and one man not make it. I can't think of anybody else through election. Omax Gardner made it, and Dick Fountain didn't make it in all that century. I'm not sure. It may have been the kinds of people that were lieutenant governor, the ones that I can think about. Well, there's some that just, you know, nobody would ever thought about. They were lieutenant governor types, period. Hodges got there through death. Claude Philpott probably would have been, and he died in office. Truth of it, when you start thinking about it, I forgot about Scott who made it. When you think about it, we may have a tradition about as strong as going from lieutenant governor to governor as we have or not going. There was a possibility. So you had somebody that died. They obviously couldn't run. I can't think of. I'm not sure that we had a tradition that's clear on that.
To ask a little bit about the Congress, if I look at North Carolina and compare it with some of the other southern states over the last 25 years, you invariably come up with some big names in the delegation who have powerful chairmanship or were very high in the committee seniority. But at least you have one or two.
We can't say about it right now because it was a time when we had three major committee chairmanships. In the last 20 years ago, we had three major committee chairmanships. One time we had four. One time we had Ways and Means, Merchant, Marine and Fisheries, Education and Labor,
and Agriculture.
So death did a lot to that.
In the last 10 years, for example.
Well, part of that's a product of having a two-party delegation. You know, having people not around long enough to get established. It's going to be harder now because of the new rules in the House that forbid you from being chairman of a committee and chairman of a subcommittee at the same time. That sort of thing that helped these other people get up there. But I think part of the reason that we're where we are right now with what is a greatly diminished influence would be because we had those four, and when they left, you know, everybody else is so far behind in the delegation. We've got a second ranking. Third rank, you know, we could have two committee chairmanships within the next two terms. Everybody stayed here. I am told by people who have been here and whose judgment I respect that our delegation has gone from where Sam Rayburn would have said at some point to somebody that it was the best from the South, where it would not be considered that at all. But it's hard for me to defend that because I didn't know those other folks.
Who were the four committee chairmen that were sheriff town?
Bob Dalton was.
Bob who?
Bob Dalton was chairman of Ways and Means. Appropriation. Ways and Means, I guess. Muley Dalton. He was here for 40 years. Graham Barden was chairman of Education and Labor. And you know, kept federal aid to education from being law for decades. Herbert Bonner was chairman of Merchant Marine and Fisheries, which is much less important committee now than it was at one time. It was important to him because he was from the coast. And Harold Cooley was chairman of the Agriculture Committee, which of course was a very important committee to North Carolina. Is a less important committee every day, I think. But that was considerable. I doubt there was probably any state in the Union that had those four in the county.
Well, what about the United States Senators?
Now, before Watergate, we had really only had one United States Senator of great influence in the Senate, and that was Frank Graham, and he was there for a very brief period of time. I don't think Senator Irvin ever has had any great desire to be, you know, he's got pretty much one area of interest and perfectly content to have that, and he always sort of let Senator Jordan handled the North Carolina business and went right along with it with Bill Cochran, really, and Senator Jordan for the years that he was up here. They were the people that did everything that required a North Carolina senator, and Senator Irvin joined in. Irvin has done more of that lately. In fact, I'm told that Holzhauser recently said to some newspaper editors that after he'd been very critical of Irvin, but please not quote him since he had to do business through his office, couldn't do it through him. But I couldn't explain. I was sort of astounded by that comment, and I think he must have made it for no reason for somebody to misquote him. And Senator Jordan, of course, was not the kind of man to wield that kind of influence. He was perfectly happy where he was, being a member of the club and being a housekeeper to the Senate, and had, you know, really considerable influence because of that. I think we could have gotten a great deal done about anything, but what he wanted to get done was limited. He was very, very popular, far more popular in the Senate, I'm sure, than Senator Irvin ever has been.
There have been several theories propounded recently about the role of Southern congressmen, one of which is that they collectively wield far less influence than they used to in the direction in which things are going, that the influence will decline even more.
They can't find any way to get together. They started last year trying to organize as a block, which may have been a mistake. I think it was easier when they were an unorganized block maybe than when they started organizing, because what they decided was that they had to organize themselves like the Democratic Study Group. And they...
Is this the World Congress?
No. They organized something that's called the... Democratic Research.
What?
The Democratic Research something. DR. They don't say group.
Are you going to say the Democratic Research Group?
No, that's not it. It has a name, and we are founding members of it. That will show you how interesting a group it is. Which goes from a meeting of that group to one that Dick Bowling has each week, which is the Democratic Moderates. We subscribe to all the research effort of the DSG, although he's not an active member of it. Anyway, we're sort of across all sorts of lines. But they've had a hard time establishing policy on anything other than sort of negative issues like busing. They started organizing themselves as Democratic supporters of the president right at the time that all of that started falling apart.
Is this the group that Wagoner has?
Well, Joe Wagoner, Sonny Montgomery. The only thing I can think of that they've done successfully is twice they've gotten together groups to go over and sit with the president.
Hold his hand?
Well, the first time they were told that they were going over to have a chance to tell him how they felt about things, that he was only hearing from partisans of his and from the press. And this group, which was sort of in the middle, would go and talk to him. And it turned out to be a pep rally, sort of embarrassing to some people like Rich who went. They've got a little staff set up now, but it is a very unorganized block, and in no way can compare with the influence of the DSG or the Republican House Conference or something like that, which are really very well organized, staffed, good research. That's all. I'm going to right now. It starts from a negative basis too. That may be part of the problem. It really does.
Can you walk over here?
Yeah.
How long does it take to
go? It'll take you, depending on how you walk, 10 to 15 minutes. I made it in under 15.
Start walking back over there.
Yeah, we can talk. That would be the quick way, Jack. I got lost trying to do that. So don't. If you can get to it, lots of luck. I wouldn't. I'm not sure that much quicker, because you have to walk 2/3 of the way anyway. You're going to Gillis's office. I think it's easy enough to walk over there above ground.
What about the rural caucus?
Well, I think that probably, although I'm not as familiar with it, I have the impression that it probably is more successful in its first year. Maybe it's because it has a limited objective and it's got some very solid people.
Yeah, but it's supposed to be based on a coalition of rural Democrats and urban Democrats.
Well, it's my understanding at the moment, it's mainly rural Democrats, and it's sort of Charlie Rose and Litton from Missouri, who's very, very, I think from Missouri or Oklahoma, very impressive person, very impressive, rich too. And I just have, I don't know that much about it, I just have an impression from what I've heard about it, that it's been more successful in its effort than this other group today.
There's one things that we've heard expressed that the 1972 congressional election in the South, insofar as Democrats are concerned, marks a turning point which new Democratic congressmen from the South tend to be more progressive, more like Democrats, vote more often with the Democratic majority. This represents a turning point. Do you have any comment on that?
First, there are three groups in the Congress, as far as I can see. One is essentially the group that gets 70% better rating from the Americans for constitutional action, whatever the ACA is. The other group gets 70% better rating from the ADA. And there is a middle group, which is sort of floats between both of those, and it's made up of about 40 or 50 Republicans and about 40 or 50 Democrats, the most prominent Republican being John Anderson, who's of course chairman of the Republican House Conference. I think that the new Southern Democrats are closely in that group. I think they're more like Northern Democrats than Joe Wagoner. But how much they're like them, I'm not sure. From issue, the House organized itself again almost on every issue in terms of parties. There are two parties each time there's an issue, and it has nothing to do with national political.
Well, the argument is that during the 60s, Democrats more and more voted with Republicans as you go through that decade.
And that now what you have starting with the 72 election is a reversal of that.
Well, it's my question when you look at the report that just came out of presidential support and that sort of thing for this first year of this Congress, that there was a shift back. But that's a combination of things. The things they were voting on, the president's problems. You had a situation here where the War Powers Bill is just made for a Southern Democrat to be to take the Congress's point of view on the War Powers Bill. But that's rated a liberal vote in the last session of Congress. A liberal vote is one of the most conservative votes they could have cast. And it would have been conservative almost any time in American history. But last year, because it was put them in a confrontation with the president, and because Republicans and conservative Republicans stayed with the president out of loyalty against what would be their philosophical inclination. You got Southerners who felt free to vote their old attitude about the Constitution and free now to vote against the president. You got them all coming up with a high rating on that one bill. But I don't think that represented such a great change on their part. But I think it is a different kind of person who wins now as a Democrat. In the first place, to win a Democratic primary in the South now, more and more you have to have some black support, some labor support in some places. So you get to be the nominee with a different kind of support maybe, and you still, there's enough party loyalty that your chances are good of being elected. So yeah, you are, to a certain extent, a different crowd of a Democrat, but then they're all, you know, what explains Rich being here? I don't know that any change in anything. We've got a district that two of the counties went for George Wallace, and Nixon's, one of Nixon's strongest districts in North Carolina, and Miss Terry's poorest district. And yet, you know, it elects Rich. And I don't think that's him. Well, in 68, when he first ran, he ran very well. There were several reasons for that, one being that all the Wallace campaign managers were supporting him. And they did as good a job of putting the word out as anybody I know. I would say that he runs well. Of course, it's hard to talk about that since he hadn't had any real, real hard opposition. But
pretty good.
City was in the rural areas, he would probably not do as well. Wallace Precinct, at least in our district, they're all kinds of places.
Do you run better in the city? Is that because of labor's influence?
No, labor, black, combination of things. He gets about 35% of the Republican vote, and it's concentrated in the city.
But I mean, in the Wallace Precinct in the city, is that because of labor's influence?
Probably is. I'm not sure.
And interview with Tom Lambeth. No more transcription on this tape. Reverse side is blank.